It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, the Trump administration announced that protections from deportation had ended for Haitians living in the U.S. under a temporary status. But the issue isn't so clear, with some unresolved issues in the court system. Temporary protected status, or TPS, applies to people from countries that have been designated as too dangerous to return to because of war, natural disaster, or other circumstances. It allows people living in the U.S. to stay and work in the country until their country is deemed safe to return to. Temporary protected status for people from Haiti began after the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that the Trump administration had the right to terminate that status, but sent the issue back to lower courts to put the ruling into effect. In the latest announcement, the Trump administration also revoked work permits that had been issued under the TPS status. Mark Christopher is an immigration attorney with offices in Appleton and Milwaukee. He's a New London resident representing some of the hundreds of Haitian immigrants in his community who might be affected by the end of their temporary protected status. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on.
There's some confusion over whether the end of temporary protected status has actually happened this week. What is your understanding of what the state of affairs is today?
Well, that's the problem. We don't know for sure. If you ask the administration, they say it has ended and ended on July 27th, 30 days after the Supreme Court decision came out. I have to tell my clients that the administration is probably going to pursue removal and deem them not to have any status here in the United States.
And one thing that is clear, the federal government has stopped issuing work permits to many people from Haiti under TPS. What are you hearing from people?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only that, but they've terminated administratively the work authorizations as of this week. So those people that have had work authorizations under TPS that have extended into, you know, the future months have been essentially administratively revoked. They have also sent notices to employers that they are no longer to hire individuals with this work authorization designation.
What kind of impact are you seeing that having, not just on the people from Haiti who are working, but their employers?
Yeah, I mean, here in Wisconsin, you know, there's not really any accurate estimates about how many Haitians we have in Wisconsin under this status. But I can tell you anecdotally, at least in my community in central Wisconsin, we have a fair number. At our local Tyson plant, it's been stated that they had over 100 workers. So imagine that if you're running a large plant, if you're running a business, imagine just out of the blue having a significant portion of your employment force being taken away. So it's affecting our businesses. The uncertainty is affecting the owners of these businesses, too.
In a statement to WPR, the Department of Homeland Security said that temporary protected status is temporary, that TPS has been allowed to function as, quote, a de facto amnesty program, despite Congress ever intending it to be permanent, end quote. They encourage people to take their offer for a flight back to Haiti and $2,600. What is your response to that statement that, yes, this is temporary, it's run a long time, but it was always going to end at some point?
Yeah, I mean, it is temporary and it is supposed to end at some point. But in the past, there has to have been some type of show from the government, from our government, that the conditions in the home country have improved. And every objective measurable about Haiti indicates that the conditions have worsened. So as you indicated on in your intro, it was designated back in 2010 after an earthquake. Well, it was redesignated a couple of years ago because of the political unrest and the fact that gangs run certain areas of Haiti with impunity. So there's been no showing that it's gotten better. It's actually gotten worse. But yet the government wants to send them back. And that was really the legal issue that was before the courts. But unfortunately, the courts have determined that the administration has unfettered discretion. And my second point to that is, I think it negates and lessens the fact of how much of an impact these individuals are making in our community, in economic-wise, socially. They become part of of the fabric of these small communities, of these businesses. Their kids are going to school. Many of these, their children are U.S. citizens.
For someone in this situation now, they appear to have lost TPS status. They've lost that work permit. What kind of legal recourse, what kind of legal options would they have if they want to stay in the United States?
Yeah, they're very, very limited. Unless they're married to a US citizen or they have a child who's over the age of 21, really the only option at that point is to file for asylum. And asylum is very difficult, very specific. You have to show why you would be targeted by the government or the group the government cannot control. Many people are certainly scared of the violence going back to their home country, but it's hard to show why they would be individualized or set aside for targeting by these groups.
Mark, thanks again for joining us today.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Mark Christopher, immigration attorney with offices in Appleton and Milwaukee. He's a new London resident representing some of the hundreds of Haitian immigrants in his community who might be affected by the end of their temporary protected status. Now we'll hear from the leader of a Haitian church in Wisconsin about what his congregants are experiencing. Maxwell Maceno is the pastor at Living Water Church in Appleton. Pastor Maceno, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
What has been the reaction for people in your congregation with this announcement of the end of protected status and the canceling of work permits for people from Haiti under temporary protected status?
It is a heart broken, and people are wondering what they are going to do. I have people who own businesses when they were in Haiti that were thriving with their family, and they had to run. And they left their businesses, and it's been looted, and it's occupied by gangs. And they have no place to go, and they live in the capital. And it's almost sending people to the butcher. And so that's, I'm talking to you here, I'm shaking, thinking about.
Our connection's breaking up a little bit. Pastor Maceno's connection is breaking up. We are talking to Pastor Max Maceno with Living Water Church in Appleton. We're talking about the end of temporary protected status for people from Haiti and the loss of their work permits. We've got, I think, Mark Christopher still on the line while we try to get Pastor Maceno's connection back up. Mark, do we still have you?
Yes, I'm still on.
Wonderful. Pastor Maceno expressing, I think, fear from people at the prospect of having to go back to Haiti. Is that what something you're hearing from your clients as well?
Yeah, absolutely. He was verbalizing exactly what I've heard from so many of my clients. I myself obviously have never been to Haiti, but in representing individuals, I have to do a lot of country conditions and review and the like. And he's absolutely right. These people would be going back to a country whereby if they had a business or a home back there, they've likely been taken over by gangs or lawless organizations, or sometimes they're targeted by a corrupt government. And imagine if you've been here for 16 years, and let's say you have a US citizen child who's 7, 8, 10 years old, who's only known the United States, and you have to make the terrible decision. Hey, am I going to go back to this country with these conditions with my child, or am I going to have my child remain here with a friend and be separated from my child? It's a terrible and unenviable decision.
I believe we have Pastor Maceno back on the line. Pastor Maceno, what kind of plans are people in your congregation making if it comes to that point where they do have to leave the country? What kind of things are they talking about?
It's one of the things our church is going to do is try to educate people to come up with a plan in case something did happen to them, and to have a plan for the child, because some of them, like the lawyer said, is that the kids who've been born here are U.S. citizens, and it's hard to believe that they would take the kids with them.
And Pastor Maceno, staying with you, have you heard of or seen any extra enforcement activity? Have members of your congregation reported being targeted by ICE or border enforcement this last week?
No, I haven't heard any of our people being affected by it. Most of them has filed for asylum, and And I haven't heard anything so far in that regard.
And Mark,
but I know that there are people who have lost their job.
And Mark, are there resources out there for people, legal or other resources, to try to make plans, to react in the case of a family member being detained and deported? What kind of help, even if limited, is out there?
Yeah, it is very limited, just because we're seeing the sudden need. Most of the help is from community organizations and small groups. Like, for example, in my hometown of New London, we have put together a number of people who are donating items. We're trying to do some free legal clinics, at least to provide some guidance. But really, people are mostly on their own. Many of these volunteers are overwhelmed with the need.
Pastor Maceno, for members of your congregation from Haiti, is there hope someday to return to Haiti in better conditions if the gang problem can be solved, if government can be made stable again? Do you think some people would willingly want to go back in that instance?
Absolutely. I have people who feel that they get stuck here. It's because that they came. They was hoping it was going to be temporary, and now they know they can't go back. In fact, I have a friend who recently been killed. His name is Rudy Jean. He was living in Cap-Haitien, and he decided to visit his mother in the capital. That was the last time they heard from him, and they found out this week he was killed. It's almost a crime to go to visit your parents.
Pastor Maceno, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mark, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Maxwell Maceno is the pastor at Living Water Church in Appleton, where congregants are being affected by the end of temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants living in the U.S. Some court issues still there to determine whether that status currently exists. And we heard from Mark Christopher, immigration attorney with offices in Appleton and Milwaukee, representing some of the hundreds of Haitian immigrants in his community. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a candidate debate, another contender drops out, and the latest polling numbers as the race for governor heads toward primary election day. Get the latest from the team at Inside Wisconsin Politics. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. With less than 2 weeks to go before the Democratic primary for governor, there's been another shakeup in the race. One of the leading candidates, Mandela Barnes, dropped out yesterday. That leaves four candidates left for voters to decide who will be the Democratic nominee. Our political reporters with Inside Wisconsin Politics look at the state of the race and where things stand before the August 11th primary. Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So just when it seemed like this Democratic primary for governor couldn't get any wilder, let's see, let's go through the candidates here. David Crowley drops out, Sarah Rodriguez drops out, David Crowley drops back in. We now have Mandela Barnes dropping out of the race. Some pretty big names there. Anya, what happened?
I mean, I will give a little behind-the-scenes intrigue for our viewers. We taped a whole different show right before this, talking about the debate, and we will get into that later. And we got the news in our earpieces that Mandela Barnes had dropped out. So he released a video on social media, and interestingly, you know, doesn't endorse another candidate, looked pretty dejected, and essentially said, we all can tell the writing is on the wall of who the nominee is going to be. I assume he is alluding to Francesca Hong, who is just carrying all these polls. And he said, you know, the number one thing to do is to beat Tom Tiffany. So it was not a ringing endorsement. It did not seem like an impassioned sort of choice to step down, but certainly some breaking news. You know, we're less than 2 weeks out from primary day.
Yeah, we got to tell you, we're recording this on a Thursday afternoon, so by the time you watch it or hear it, you may know more about this story than we do right at this moment. We can tell you right now from the Journal Sentinel, the decisions by the Barnes camp, they said, came amid reporting into allegations that Barnes was taking advantage of his role in the party to have sexual encounters with young adult women. We also read from Politico, the announcement comes as Democratic officials in the state brace for damaging media reports. So, I mean, Zach, there are different circumstances under which a candidate can drop out. It can be received in different ways. How would you characterize this one?
Well, this is different from past episodes, including the flip side of this when Mandela Barnes took advantage of this in 2022 in his Senate run, when the other opponents in that primary dropped out. And they dropped out gracefully, saying the only way at that time for them to win the nomination would be to go negative and hurt the party, and they decided not to do that. And they were rewarded for that as being team players down the road. Sarah Godlewski was appointed treasurer. We've seen examples of this almost 2 decades ago. Scott Walker was going to run for governor in 2006. Party officials said, hey, why don't you clear the field for Mark Green? He did, and then he was the nominee in 2010 when party officials remembered he was graceful about that. So on one hand, it could be seen as Mandela Barnes seeing the writing on the wall. He wasn't going to win, but he has a future in Democratic politics in Wisconsin. That would be the normal way to look at this, as saying, well, there's lots of future races he could run for. But then when you combine this with the reporting that we're hearing and the rumors that have been running around circles for quite a while now, it doesn't have that same tone to it. So this looks more of getting ahead of the damaging news that could be dropping, less Graham Plattner in the East Coast Senate race, and more of just keep your head down and get out of the way, so it becomes less of a distraction and he's forced to bow out disgracefully as opposed to bowing out on his own terms.
Yeah, you know, you alluded to there, but in his message he did not say Francesca Hong's name. He didn't say I'm dropping out because she's the front runner, and that's good. He didn't say, I'm dropping out and I support a challenger, because he's kind of had some fights with them recently. Rich, you reported on Mandela Barnes this campaign and in 2022. He entered this race and presented himself as the front runner, and it seemed like that sort of slowly slipped away during this campaign. And now this, quite a shocking arc to his story this year.
In terms of name recognition, he did enter the race with more than any of the other candidates, including Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany. And that was because of the 2022 Senate loss to Ron Johnson. It was a close race, but there was a lot of advertising, so his name got around. But that race really hurt him also, beyond whatever is going to be reported or is being reported at this moment about any improprieties. He was damaged from that Senate loss to Ron Johnson among Democrats. Even before he jumped into the race for governor, there was an op-ed that had former Lieutenant Governor Barbara Lawton, a Democrat that is very involved in the party, said that he shouldn't get in the race, that he's proven that he can't win statewide, etc. So there was that. And then we started seeing in the earlier days of this gubernatorial primary among the Democrats, where people were dropping out. They weren't endorsing Barnes like they did in 2022. So that was a signal. Then Governor Evers endorsed someone besides Barnes, who, you know, Barnes and Evers served together for years. So that was a sign. And now here we are. It's really been just a really interesting ride for Barnes.
So his departure kind of leaves the race in some ways where it was, where there seems to be this growing consensus out there that this is Francesca Hong's race to lose. She is a Democratic Socialist, which has sort of defined this campaign. She was asked about her views at this week's debate. Let's give a listen to what she had to say.
What democratic socialism is a form of government that puts working class people first, that puts work first. The policies that we have been working on, permanent affordability, has broad bipartisan support in every corner of the state.
Anya, you've covered her campaign. You profiled her for Wisconsin Public Radio. How is she presenting her brand of politics to primary voters and also potentially critics as this primary closes out?
Yeah, I think she's been really consistent, not just throughout this campaign, but, you know, throughout her political career. She was a member of the Democratic Socialist Caucus in the Assembly. She's running as a Democratic Socialist on the Democratic ticket. And so you've seen that a lot in her policy positions. I think a little bit what we saw on the debate stage was her trying to nuance some of that, perhaps for a more general election, again, as she is this kind of runaway favorite at the moment. I saw some criticism actually from national DSA members on social media who were saying essentially, oh, she's not socialist enough. But I think she understands that there is going to be a pretty ready-made line of attack from Republicans based on some of her past statements, based on calling for defunding the police, based on aligning with certain, you know, sort of far left, more like agitated sort of online figures, that gives them easy things to kind of clip, which can really kind of be hard to oppose from a more kind of nuanced position. And so I think we saw her on the debate stage kind of trying out some of these more biteable, clippable ways of approaching her politics.
Yeah, part of the question that led to that answer there was, hey, the Democratic Socialists of America stand for getting rid of prisons, getting rid of the Senate. Are you with them? And she said she didn't agree with them on everything. But Zach, I do kind of sense from her a pivot toward the general election in terms of the way that she's answering these questions, you know, on, I don't know, you name it, tax policy, on defund the police, you know, what stood out to you?
She's definitely nuancing those positions because in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. That phrase has been around for a long time. So she's trying to explain to general election voters that she's not that kind of socialist. She's a democratic socialist because Republicans are comparing her to Venezuela. I mean, that's Tom Tiffany's line of attack that I heard on Tuesday night during the debate. I was covering one of his events. And he's saying, well, if you want to know about socialism, you just have to look at Venezuela when they're eating the animals and they're eating their shirts and there's nothing available for anybody. And that's what's coming to Wisconsin if you looked Francesca Hong. That's what you're going to hear from them. So her trying to go more on the lines of the old Milwaukee socialists, like the sewer socialists they were called, of like, let's work on infrastructure and public schools and the public good, the public welfare. She's trying to get ahead of some of those attacks and explain that's where her socialist policies lie, less in the international communist socialist stuff that we hear from the countries that fall apart that claim to be socialist.
And Rich, you covered the debate. She was asked about, I mean, everybody there on that debate stage was saying, let's tax millionaires to pay for stuff in state government. She got a little more specific than others, and yet it seemed like potentially an incomplete answer based on her record.
Yeah, that's right. Her website has all kinds of very specific numbers, and also she's been in the assembly for some time now, and she's taken a lot of votes. She's introduced a lot of legislation. So on the debate stage, essentially she was saying, well, for millionaires, it'd be a 1% tax increase to something like 8.6% versus, you know, whatever it is now. So she said that, but right away online, Democrats even were saying, well, you know, actually, she's got a plan to create a new tax bracket and set it at 17 point something percent. Which is true. That was part of a plan she put out in the legislature. So she talked really generally about it. And so then others had to go and dig up what she said in the past.
Yeah. We did mention last week that we were going to wait for another story to develop, this police shooting in Madison. And you've heard all the candidates for governor come out and say, you know, we need to have a swift investigation of that. Zach, I think it's fair to say that Francesca Hong's response to the shooting was certainly the most attention getting. She went out to the site of the shooting with a bullhorn and called it an execution. What is she saying now? And, you know, why'd she use that word in her words?
Well, she was asked during the debate, would you make the same statement as governor? And her answer was no, because the governor has a bigger megaphone, and essentially alluding it wouldn't be appropriate for the governor to make that statement. What's interesting is you're supposed to campaign how you govern, and she did make that statement as a candidate, only a few weeks away from a primary. And the video of her doing it, the crowd is clearly trying to goad her into using the word murder. And she, at that moment, takes a pause and then says execution. So she was even calibrating what she was saying in that moment. This wasn't as much of an off-the-cuff statement as you might think. When you cover her in speeches, she is very measured in her thought and her speech. She pauses before she answers a question. She's thinking about, it's not just letting the words fly like we see on social media sometimes with some politicians and then worry about retracting it later. So for her to use that word was a deliberate, intentional thing. And then to say, well, I wouldn't as governor, does call into question, like, what is the line then? Why use it now in this case and not? And we know it will be used against her. Tom Tiffany's already talking about that. They're attacking the Democratic candidate simply because the street where the shooting took place is still shut down by protesters, saying that Madison needs to get control of the streets and that as governor, he would obviously have that street open by now. So they're going to use this against her as a candidate, assuming that she wins this primary. And the question is, how does she continue explaining those statements and those votes to general election voters?
Let's talk about David Crowley, Milwaukee County's executive, who got back in this race as the Francesca Hong alternative. And I got to think that Mandela Barnes' departure from this race potentially changes the calculus for him. Rich, what were we hearing from, you know, David Crowley as it relates to Francesca Hong up to this point in the race? And, you know, has it been catching on? Is there a sign that this theory that Crowley supporters had is actually working?
Well, the claim that we've heard from David Crowley and some of the other Democratic candidates is that the Republican Governors Association is essentially trying to get Hong elected during the primary so that it would be easier for Tom Tiffany to defeat her. So that was the line going into it.
I will say one thing about those ads that you mentioned, the Republican ads. I think they are kind of they're serving two goals right now for Republicans. They're kind of getting bang for their buck in a couple ways. I do think there's a pretty strong case to be made that they were there to kind of prop up Francesca Hong. They're saying that she's a very liberal candidate in these liberal media markets. But I think now Republicans do view her as the general election candidate in the way that they're talking about her. So they are kind of getting a head start on these attacks in some way. Anya, David Crowley and Mandela Barnes were kind of going at it as their candidacies progressed in this race, as Mandela Barnes kind of felt like David Crowley had blocked his path. Now that Mandela Barnes is out of the way, is there a boost coming for Crowley?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is possible that among other concerns, Mandela Barnes felt snubbed by the fact that Governor Tony Evers backed Crowley and not him. He was his lieutenant governor. And so we saw barbs, I mean, like almost schoolyard barbs on social media, primarily coming from Barnes towards Crowley, but then Crowley would sort of respond in kind. So really, like a really kind of, it felt like bad blood between them. One of the arguments that the Barnes camp has been making as other candidates have dropped out is we will absorb those votes. And so now part of the question is where will these remaining sort of Barnes votes go? Will they go further left towards Hong? Will they go further towards the center, towards Crowley? And of course, I haven't checked the numbers recently, but as of last week, 100,000 absentee ballots had already been turned in. I imagine that number is much higher now. So there's also the question of, like, of the remaining voters who haven't cast their ballots, some of them are undecided. But those who were leaning towards Barnes, now where are they going to go? Especially if, you know, these allegations start to come out and it becomes an even more chaotic news cycle that distracts from the actual sort of meat of the campaign.
Rich, you know, real quick on that law, that on those ballots, there was a lawsuit filed to try to get them counted. Judge ruled on that this week. What does that mean for those absentee ballots?
Well, yeah, the judge dismissed or denied to issue an injunction, essentially blocking the Wisconsin Elections Commission guidance, saying that you cannot, if you have sent in your absentee ballot, you cannot ask for it to be spoiled and get a new one. So essentially what that means is that people who have already cast ballots for, you know, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez, Mandela Barnes, Missy Hughes, they're essentially out of luck at this point. So unless that changes, unless this is rushed through an appeal process up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court makes a ruling before August 11th, it kind of seems like those votes will be counted, but they won't go anywhere.
Zach, we had a couple polls out this week. They both showed Francesca Hong with at least a 20-point lead. You know, one of them showed Mandela Barnes. Marquette showed Mandela Barnes in second. David Crowley down at about 7%. But in the Marquette poll, we're looking at a third of voters still undecided. Now Mandela Barnes is out of the race. You got all those undecided voters. David Crowley's still there. Could this race shake up and change in the closing days?
Well, every time we say no, we're proven wrong. It does get shaken up by larger events than what we probably could have predicted on this show. But the question is there enough room for anyone to gain enough ground to catch the lead that Francesca Hong looks like she has? Just talking about those absentee ballots that have been cast, they're not getting counted back. The question will be, once this race is all over, will the margin of votes that Mandela Barnes and Rodriguez received add up to the amount that the second place person took, or will they have made a difference in some spoiling manner? That'll be interesting math to see, but by then we'll have a winner.
Yeah, we're either going to have a massive comeback here by one of these candidates coming back to, I guess, edge out Francesca Hong at the end, or else we're going to have the most interesting governor's race in the country this November between a Democratic socialist and somebody that Democrats will paint as an election denier in Tom Tiffany. So get ready for a lot of money and ads to come to your state of Wisconsin, which we are very used to. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. This has been Inside Wisconsin Politics.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer. Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org. Coming up, a summer camp in Maquanago celebrates 130 years, and just like the 1800s, it's still screen-free.
We always like to make sure that we provide an experience that makes them say, wow, that was so fun, I didn't even need my phone for the whole week.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about living between two worlds.
How do you define home if you've grown up in multiple places? It's a question Paul Lohr of Kimberly has grappled with for years. So he went to visit his first home for clarity. He shares his story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
What is it like to call one of the most secret places on earth home? In the 1970s, I lived there, and then I left. For much of the 1960s and 1970s, this place I called home was closed to the outside world. For the past 60 years or so, it was one of the most dangerous places in the world to visit. After 45 years away, I finally had the opportunity to return home. It's a home that's far, far away from Kimberly, Wisconsin, where my family now lives. It's a home somewhere in Central Laos. From an early age, the thought of one day returning home intrigued me, fascinated me, and motivated me. Back in November 2022, I was finally home. I made it to Vientiane, Laos. My main goal was to retrace the path that many Hmong, including my family, took in the 1970s to seek refuge in Thailand. From Vientiane, my wife, Maya, and I, along with our driver and his wife, headed to Longsan. Along the journey, we drove by a section of the Mekong River, where many Hmong, including my family, crossed to seek refuge in Thailand. This is where I lost my mother and one of my two sisters. Like many Hmong making this journey, my mother and sister drowned. We could not salvage their bodies to give them proper burials. I was about 5 or 6 years old. As we were departing the area, Maya whispered to me, "Any tears inside of you?" I, of course, had many unexplained emotions, but replied, "No, they dried up a long time ago." Our next stop was Mun Aw, the last village my family lived in before leaving for Thailand. Standing on the outskirts of Mun Aw, I saw the entire village. I can still visualize our hut. I felt so relieved to finally see a place that I thought I would never see again. The next day, we visited several remaining historical landmarks from the secret war in Laos, which is a secret military operation by the United States to counter communism in Laos and Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s. First, we stopped by Phu Biat, which is the tallest mountain in Laos. This is where my father was assassinated. This site was the last stronghold for the Hmong, who supported the United States and stayed behind after the United States had already left Southeast Asia in 1975. Visiting here makes the few wonderful memories I still have of my father even more meaningful. After a week visiting my Laos home, I returned to my Wisconsin home, enlightened, enriched, and fulfilled. I finally felt at peace. I finally come to embrace that my far, far away home in Laos is no longer my home. It's simply now a part of my past. Home is now Kimberly, Wisconsin.
Paul Lohr is the Associate Dean of the School of Education at UW-La Crosse. His story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. Let's go back to 1896. The president was Grover Cleveland. The very first gas-powered cars had just rolled out onto Detroit streets. Also in 1896, Phantom Lake YMCA Summer Camp in Maquonago opened. This year, this outdoor camp for kids celebrates its 130th birthday, making it one of the oldest operating summer camps in North America. Charlie Lovett is a second-generation staff member with the camp's Youth Leadership Development Program, and Jeff Spang is CEO of the Phantom Lake YMCA Summer Camp. They spoke with Kate Archer-Kent.
Jeff, starting with you, you've been running this camp as CEO for 20 years now. That's a small portion of the camp's total lifetime so far. What does it mean to you to be part of its long legacy?
Oh, it's humbling to me. It's such an honor to carry on the traditions of camp and to truly serve children and families. So I'm honored to be in this position to carry on all of the wonderful traditions and making sure today's youth still had the opportunity to have the same experiences of previous generations.
Traditions are so important generation after generation for summer camp. How has the camp experience changed even over your 2 decades?
Well, I think number one is we really truly have an obsession with safety. So we want to lead the field, lead the industry in safety. So we actually hired a director of safety to oversee all safety procedures and risk management of camp. And that has really improved our quality of camp. And parents see it. So when they see something that we're making a move like that, they're more willing to send their kids to camp.
Charlie, you have such a close history with this camp going back to when you were just 7. What was it like to be a camper at Phantom Lake? What were your earliest memories?
Well, I would say that I always had a blast. I would show up only just for 1 week in the summer, but I was always so excited to go play games in our forest. We call it the Kettles. And also just get to know the fellow campers that I had in my cabin as well. I've made some pretty lifelong friends dating back all the way to when I was 7 that I still keep in contact with even now. And it's been really much a blast and keeps me coming back every summer.
Now you're leading the junior counselors. What are some of the values that you try to instill in your young leaders?
So, like Jeff mentioned, we always try to instill safety as our number one priority, of course. But then also, we want to make sure that our counselors are our junior counselors are learning how to take initiative, one that will help them be able to hopefully lead the camp in the future when they're old enough to join staff, but also sort of creates a good system for outside of camp as well. I feel like when I was a junior counselor at camp, a lot of the lessons that I learned in this program are things that I carried out into everyday life and that really helped me grow and mature.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. So I think I was always a bit timid before I was a junior counselor, before I started working. And they always encouraged just being your true self and always never being afraid to be embarrassed, being really out there, meeting new people, experiencing new things. And doing that at camp is really easy because we have such a welcoming environment where everyone feels comfortable to do so. It's such a welcoming place. And that gave me the confidence to go express myself more outside. And I always try to emphasize that with the junior counselors as well, to not be afraid to take risks, to be yourself, to always put your best foot forward. If that makes sense.
Yes. Jeff, what is the value of the camp having many of its counselors grow up with that camp experience background?
Well, they can, again, carry on that tradition and instill those same wonderful leadership skills that they were taught into that next generation. And it's amazing to me to see how resilient these kids can be and teaching resiliency, that leadership, making sure that they understand that they're superheroes to that next generation coming in. So if a 7-year-old comes in, looks up to a 20-year-old and sees this is the coolest person they've ever met, and then that 20-year-old is really representing camp with some great values. So that's what continues the tradition.
Let's talk about electricity or the lack thereof. Campgoers not able to have their screens and doing without cell phones. Charlie, how hard is it to maintain an unplugged environment with these campers?
Well, in my experience, it's always pretty easy. We always make it clear to parents beforehand that we are an unplugged camp, so no technological devices are allowed. And really, I think the kids have always really been into it. We always like to make sure that we provide an experience that makes them say, wow, like that was so fun. I didn't even need my phone for the whole week.
So you don't feel like you have to help campers adapt to the lack of amenities that they've never gone without?
I think maybe on the first day it's a bit of an adjustment, but camp's got so many different fun activities, got so many things to do that don't involve a phone screen at all, that really speak for themselves and that the campers get really into.
Jeff, why keep the camp an electricity-free site?
Well, I think it's so critical for kids to be detached from screens. And you can see it. I'm so blessed to be able to see it every single day here. You hear the laughter, you see the fun, you see the smiles, and they're getting reconnected with each other, and they're getting reconnected to nature. So the screens can be an addiction, so we want to make sure that they can experience something incredibly fun without the screen. So when they go back home, there's more opportunities for them just to have fun without any screen time.
Mm. Jeff, this camp, it has survived through the Great Depression, world wars, at least 2 pandemics. What about this camp's culture makes it so resilient?
Well, I think, again, parents understand the value of sending their... Back in 1896, they understood the value of having a child go to camp where they can... They could... In 1896, they were being disconnected from the crazy things that were happening in the city and all the hard work. So they saw the value of having a child experience something as wonderful, the nature and the, and again, being face to face with each other and laughing out loud. So that has truly carried us through where we understand that core principle of making sure a child can be a child can have fun, and they can gain traction. So when they go back, they can, they're able to face the tough difficulties of the world much better because of their experience at camp.
Charlie, camps often have their own traditions. Sometimes they have their own words and inside jokes or songs. Is there a legacy tradition for your camp that you try to pass on?
Well, one that I absolutely adore is at the end of the week, every week, we have what's called Square. And the logo of our camp is what we call the Phantom Square, and it's a representative of a Bible verse that we have, Luke 2:52, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. And so at Square, four counselors will sit around a wooden square that we have, and they'll each tell a story that involves them either growing in wisdom or in stature or in favor with God or man. And we just like to represent how camp helps people grow and how camp touches the lives of everyone who walks onto camp. It touches the lives of our counselors, of our junior counselors, and especially our campers.
Jeff, this camp also is serving all children, regardless of disability. Can you talk a little bit about the inclusive nature of Phantom Lake YMCA?
This is one of the most special things that has happened in the last 20 years, where we want to make sure camp is available to any child and every child. So we have a special fundraiser that takes care of the additional resources it needs that we need to have to serve these children. And we want to make sure that these families have a choice. And that's, if you talk to a family of, for example, if you talk to a family of a that has a child with autism, they're so limited on their choices as far as where they can send their kid, where they can send their kids, where they feel very safe and nurtured. And we wanted to be that space, and we wanted to make sure that they could experience camp right alongside every other child. And it's been incredible. It's been amazing to see not only the growth of the child with special needs, but all the kids around them. And it is really fabulous to see it.
Well, Jeff and Charlie, thank you so much for sharing Phantom Lake with us and the experience.
Thank you, Kate. Certainly appreciate your time, and I hope you can come and visit us one of these days.
Oh, that would be fabulous. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about Camp Kate.
Jeff Spang is CEO of the Phantom Lake YMCA Summer Camp, and Charlie Lovett is a second-generation staff member with the camp's Youth Leadership Development Program. They spoke with Kate Archer-Kent talking about the Phantom Lake YMCA Summer Camp in Muquanago in southeastern Wisconsin, celebrating its 130th anniversary of hosting campers this year. This is a big weekend for music festivals in Wisconsin with a lot of variety to choose from, including the County Line Country Fest in Prairie du Chien, the One Fest Christian Music Festival in Cadott, and kicking off on Sunday, the Door County Jazz Festival, just to name a few. And I'll be at the WPR stage at the Mile of Music Festival in Appleton tomorrow and Sunday, introducing a great lineup of performers. I'll spend some time at the WPR table out in front in the Lawrence University Chapel, so stop by and say hi if you're there. Mile of Music started yesterday. Organizers say all event locations were ready to roll despite the severe weather earlier this week and the tornado that came to Menasha and part of Appleton. In an announcement yesterday, they say they'll donate a portion of merchandise sales for relief efforts, and they're planning a follow-up Mile of Love fundraiser concert. If you're a musical festival fan, what are your favorite music events in Wisconsin, big or small? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or text or leave a message at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Joe Tarr, and Royce Podeswa. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Our acting executive producer is Tim Peterson. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.